Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of Chicago Bullseye. This is a special episode of the Bullseye. We're going to do a little bit more reminiscing as this season winds down to get our minds off the Bulls wasteland that currently is the 2018-19 season. In this episode, we were able to get together two legends from the Ball podcast, the great Big Dave and C-Dub. Big Dave also of Bulls Outsiders and Bulls historian, sports historian, one of my favorites, Jack Silverstein, who is a genius when it comes to remembering a lot of these facts about the Bulls of the 90s. We get into a number of topics. What was our greatest moment, our most nervous moment for the first three-peat here? This is going to be a two-part episode. So this covers the team from about 91 to 94 before Rodman came. And for those of you who didn't experience it, I hope you enjoy it. We're going to probably have a few of these, so if you have any questions that come up in regard to this podcast, feel free to email me at chicagobullseye@gmail.com, chicagobullseye@gmail.com, or on Twitter at CBEFred, on Twitter at CBEFred, CRedFred. You can just do a search for me. Until then, all the best, my friends, and enjoy us reminiscing about a brighter time, the beloved Bulls of the early 90s.
Hi, this is Neil Funk, and you're listening to Freck on the Chicago Bullseye.
Hello, this is Nick Friedel, and you're listening to Freck on the Chicago Bullseye. Hi, this is Chuck Swirsky, and you're listening to Freck on the Chicago Bullseye.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to a special edition of the Chicago Bullseye. This is what we call our Dynasty Edition. As we, in these dark times of the current situation with the beloved Bull, we decided to reminisce and go back and talk about the team in the better days of the 90s Bulls and the Dynasty years. The first three-peat, the second three-peat. For this one specifically, we're just going to focus on the first three-peat, the years 91 and 93. When things were much brighter in the world of the beloved Bull. So let's go around and a really quick intro for everyone. Let's start out with you, Big Dave. How you doing, bud?
What's going on, man? Big Dave, co-host of Ball, thoughts on ballsports.com, and check me out on Bulls Outsiders with Matt and John on NBC Sports Chicago following every Bulls game.
Awesome. C-Dub.
Yeah, C-Dub. I'm also the other half of Ball Sports. Check me out on Ball Sports One. That's my Twitter account. I'm actually on Twitter, so yeah.
Yay!
All right. And then the historian, Jack.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Jack Silverstein here, Read Jack. And where am I from? Just over here reading things and sharing it with people.
Great. Guys, well, I'm really excited about this because, you know, one thing I realize is, as I'm sure you all do, as we're on Twitter, there's so many fans that have no memory. Some of them didn't even exist when we got to watch, you know, the glory years of the Bulls from 91 to 93 and then obviously 96 and 98. So I think I'd like to kind of like use this time, and we're going to go over a lot of the topics for the first three-peat. But I think this will hopefully, as we share our memories of these of that great era, hopefully we can share with the listeners, you know, what it was like. Give them some kind of idea what it was like to witness greatness and to give them hope that maybe one day we can achieve it again. So let's start out with the first topic, which Jack, thanks again for a lot of your work in putting this together, but I think this is a great one. Would the Bulls have won in 94 if MJ didn't retire and was an eight-peat in play? Let's start out with you, Jack, on that one.
Yeah, I think the Bulls definitely were going to win in 94. You know, we saw in 96 the way that Phil utilized that kind of, like, it's basically like the first Warriors lineup, and it was in some ways a descendant of the 70 Knicks with that Phil, you know, played for with Clyde and Willis Reed and Dave DeBuscher and all those guys. And so in 96, you know, he put together that crazy lineup where you had Rodman at center and Kukoc, Harper, Jordan, Pippen. So four ball handlers. Well, right on the eve of the 94 season, Phil gave an interview to Sam Smith, and he basically laid out the exact same thing, because that was going to be Kukoc's rookie year. So they were going to finally see Kukoc with Jordan and Pippen, and you had Grant. I think the 96 lineup is a little crazier, but the 94 team still would have been incredible I mean, in reality, Scottie Pippen went on to win All-Star MVP, could have won the MVP. The one tricky part is that somehow the dirty little secret of the Bulls dynasty is that the centers that we played in the finals were Vlade Divac, and then no one was better than him. We had Duckworth and Mark West and Irvin Johnson and Ostertag and then Greg Foster a little bit in 98. So it had been real interesting to see us up against Hakeem. I would have liked that in 94 or 97. AP, not a chance. It needed to do what it did.
Great stuff there, Jack. C-Dub, what about you? What do you think? Would they have gone for an AP?
You know, it's funny with the... if you would say, like, back then that a team would have won, you know, 73 games and a quarterback would win, would have won 2-9 Super Bowls, you know, you'd be like, no, that can't happen. That's never going to happen again. Or it was told back then that some guy who's like 6'8", 200-some pounds, like LeBron James, was going to dominate the NBA. I would have said, no, no way, that cannot happen. Now, back then, I would have said it cannot happen. But me, right now, in 2019, why not? You know, I just have a hard time betting against Michael Jordan. I just do. You know, that Houston series would be very interesting because Vernon Maxwell guarded Jordan very well.
He did.
He got up Jordan very well, but he didn't guard playoff Jordan. So that's a whole different animal, different beast. But I think it would have been a really entertaining series. And sure, we didn't play a king, but Luke Longley was not a bad center at all. Luke Longley was a respectable center. And Akeem Olajuwon would have to get the ball to score. And the Bulls' defense was very good. And I think they would have somehow prevented a king from getting the ball as often as he wanted.
Yeah, I mean, we played him, you know, we played him in the regular season. We did decently. He hated playing Cartwright. It's not like we didn't go through, like, top centers in the East. It was just always, like, curious. It was just funny that, like, we never hit a good center in the finals.
In the finals.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
In the finals, yeah. No, obviously, you played him elsewhere.
Obviously, yeah, Ewing we had, and, you know, Rick Smits I would consider to be a great center when he was in Indiana. You know, let me just jump in really quick, because I think what's so fascinating about the year after Jordan retired was that team was really, outside, obviously, of Jordan, was kind of an interesting meld of the first three-peat and the second three-peat. You know, Steve Kerr was on that team. Tony Kukoc was on that team. Luke Longley was on that 93-94 team. Bill Wennington. You know, it really had a lot of those guys. Even Will Perdue was, but still had a lot of guys from the first one with B.J. Armstrong and Horace Grant and Will Perdue. I don't think there's any doubt that that team would have gone to the finals and beat Houston. I do think they would have lost it the subsequent year because Horace left, and that's where they were really missing a power forward, and it showed in the playoffs. And it wasn't until they found the answer in Dennis Rodman in, you know, 96 that they really dominated again. But you really needed that elite power forward as the third guy. And they didn't have it in 95. But, they, you know, obviously they found it with Rodman. What about you, Big Dave?
In 94, there's really no doubt in my head that they would have won that title. Because if you look at that team, you know, even when Mike left, they still were, what, a three seed, still won over 50 games. Scottie Pippen had really come into his own. B.J. Armstrong had an all-star season. I mean, Horace Grant really hit his stride also. They lost in the playoffs on a foul, you know, a foul in game 7.
Right.
And we all said whoever won that series was going to the finals. So they were on their way to a finals outside of a Hugh Hollins call without Michael Jordan. So adding Michael Jordan to that, yeah. You're going to the finals, and you're going to win. Now, as far as an eight-peat is concerned, it's hard for me to say that, but as Chris just said, Chris and I have two rules. We don't bet against Tom Brady, and we don't bet against Michael Jordan. We're not doing that because we're not in the habit of doing that. It's hard for me to say because I've yet to see Mike lose in that situation. I mean, because I'm never going to see it, you know, because obviously it can't happen anymore. But I never saw him lose, and I never saw a scenario where I was like, no, you know what, Mike's going to lose this one. Or Mike should have lost this one, you know, in the finals. I always felt like, no, Mike's going to win. No, Mike's going to win. It didn't matter how the deck was stacked or whatever. I just always felt he was going to win. It would have been difficult for an eight-peat. In my head, logically, I don't see it happening. But I will not bet against it. Like, I won't put any money on that.
What was the best team of the first three-peat in your opinion, and what was your favorite team of the first three-peat? Jack, let's start with you.
You know, I always thought the best team was 92. I asked Craig Hodges who would win between the, quote, best first three-peat team and the best second three-peat team, and I presumed that it was 92-96. And he was like, no, 91, that was the best team. Because he was just like, we were just fully together and unstoppable. I don't like to disagree with actual players. I think I would still say 92, although they struggled more in the playoffs. But my favorite team, even though I loved Hodges and Cliff Lemmingson, my favorite team was 93. Because I always liked the, oh, we're underdogs again feeling.
What do you think, C-Dub?
Yeah, kind of. 91, really?
Like, well, yeah, that was what he said.
That's interesting. My favorite one of my, oh, man. I'll just say that 92.
Was your favorite or the best?
We don't have a favorite. I have a favorite finals. As far as team, I don't have a, look, oh, man, that's hard. I've never really thought about it. Man, if I have to choose one, I guess it would be the 91. That's because the first one. And you saw Michael finally understand how to sort of win the team. So Scotty dominate in the finals. So that's the first one. And I remember just where I was at when it happened, watching the game, chilling, and just like, it finally happened. Yeah, it's hard for me to choose a favorite team. I have the finals I like the best.
Mm-hmm. Which is that?
With the Portland finals. That one with Clyde Drexler, because even though I knew Michael, you know, of course, was better than Clyde Drexler, but he came into the finals with the purpose of making a point. And when he hit those threes, those six threes, I lost my mind.
Yeah.
It was like he could do nothing wrong. It was, I could not believe this man decided to do this in the finals. Like, every time, he always just had me in awe over something. And when he did that, it was like, okay, they're going to win. I don't know how the story's going to play out, the beginning and the middle, but the end is going to end up with the Bulls winning. And then he did something in that finals. They go back to the game. He did something in that game six, which was amazing, was that he had a bad first half. They had the nerve to get benched and come back in. They have a good, like, his, like, what, six shots or something like that. It was crazy. I've never seen a guy go from being cold to being hot in the game.
Well, that game six, you know, that fourth quarter comeback.
Yes.
And doing it with the bench. You know, the four backups plus Pippen. I mean, that's an awesome memory. And that was, you know, we won the first title in L.A., and even though I never went to a finals game, I didn't go to a Bulls playoff game until 2005. So it's not like I would have been there, but even so, there was still something about knowing, like, the team had won in Chicago.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, yeah, it was our house and all that. Like, that was a lot of fun. It was fun in a way that the road ones weren't, even though technically it's like it's the same deal. I'm at my house either way, but like it felt better knowing it was happening here.
Yeah, I agree. And yeah, I think then Patrick had the ball, won the ball, run around the court, people turn over cars. You're right, there was like a pride, you're right, there was like the strong, like, it finally happened in this city.
Yeah.
In this city. It was like a really prideful moment if you're a Bulls fan.
What about you, Big Dave?
Well, Jack, to add to what you said about Craig Hodges, I talked to Horace Grant and Will Perdue, and I asked them the same thing. And both of them, without hesitation, said 91.
They said 91 was the better team. The best
both
team.
Of them. I'm the best. Both, without hesitation. And they both said what Hodges said. He said we were just so locked in.
The first one? That's so interesting.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
What were you saying, Fred?
The first, so the one that beat the Lakers. They said that was the better team.
Yeah, the one that beat
team.
The Lakers.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, they feel that was the best one. And Jack, I have mine exactly like you have yours. I thought their best team was 92.
Yes.
Because after 91, for me, in my head, a switch clicked on, like, we're never losing again. And I never felt that whole season. I just knew we were the best team from the preseason all the way to the finals. There was nothing in my body that had a worry or a concern about any other team in the NBA. Not one worry, to the point that I remember missing some of game two because I was out riding my bike, and I was riding, and I was halfway away from my house, and I said, oh, snap, the game is on, and I stopped pedaling fast to get home, and I missed. I missed this, like the first half of game two, because this is how loose I was about it. Like, I didn't, if you knew me back then, man, you knew I wasn't missing nothing Bulls related. And the fact that it wasn't even on my mind, and it says a lot, because I wasn't even concerned about it, man. But for me, it was the 92 team, man. That team had just hit a stride and clicked in a way that I don't think I had seen, you know, here. You know what I mean? Maybe a Lakers team had done it, but, you know, again, I wasn't following them, you know, and maybe Pistons team did it, but I wasn't following them. But from the Bulls, when they won that first one, I felt that thing click. My favorite one is definitely 93. That was my favorite team. Like you said, Jack, it was the one where, for me, I didn't feel the underdog. For me, it felt like we were superheroes. By going into that third one, like, I was just in a place of, you know, just like, wow, dude, like, you're floating, like, Neo realized you was the one, you know what I'm saying? Like, you're just like, oh, man, we could, like, we reached a whole nother level that we ain't even knowing about, and, which is interesting, because we'll get into this later about, you know, the most nervous and everything like that, but definitely that was my favorite team, was watching them, 93, man, and Yeah, that was my favorite one. I
liked it a lot. So, you know, my favorite, and I thought the best team was the 92 team. And there's I got a pretty easy reason why. I mean, I think it's kind of hard for people listening to comprehend the loser reputation that Chicago had for a long time before the Bulls came around. Like, even from 1963, I think it was, till 85, we had zero titles. Two full decades, basically. And, you know, the 85 Bears, undoubtedly great. You know, they really disappointed in retrospect. They won one Super Bowl, and all those legendary players didn't achieve anything else after that. So I still think in 91 there was still this palpable attitude that, you know, Chicago was nowhere near Boston, nowhere near L.A. or New York in terms of a winning sports town. And
yeah, no doubt, that was the loser city.
It was the loser city, second city, everything about it. And, you know, so when they won that first title, that was great. That was great. But the second year was the year I really felt like where Jordan kind of took that albatross and he just smashed it forever. And I still remember, like it was yesterday, when that first game of the finals against the Trailblazers. I was working second shift at the Nabisco plant over off of Kedzie, trying to pay my way through college. And I was working 4 to midnight, and my father, the car broke down. My dad picked me up, and I asked him to tape the game because I missed the first game. And I get in the car, and I'll never forget. I go, all right. And he's just smiling, and I'm like, what happened? You know, he's like, you just got to watch. So I go home, and I witness that game with Jordan from about, you know, 12:30 a.m. to about, I'd say, I watched it about three times. I stayed up all night and watched it three times over. I still remember looking, and I finally watched it recently with my son, and this is the game, of course, where Jordan had the 6 3-pointers in the first half. And I remember looking over that it was a screenshot of Jordan's line. And it was something like 11 for 15, 30 points. And it was like 4 minutes left in the second quarter. So I paused it. I paused it and I looked over to my son. I go, Ben, do you see this line? And he looks at it. Yeah, it's the second quarter, Ben. Like, laughing our asses off that this guy could be that great to have. I mean, anyone else in the NBA, that, you know, that was like a Steph Curry line last year for the game. He had that in the second quarter.
Right.
Just insane. And then I'll never forget watching it again, and I had the same, I remember the feeling I had, was after a timeout, there's two back-to-back plays. When he hit the 6 3-pointer, right before that, it was a steal by Pippen, missed the layup, out of nowhere, Jordan dunks it. And the next play down, he hit the 6 3-pointer after another stop. It was just, it's hard to describe the feeling to have, and it's the only time I've ever had it in the city. Living here for all these years and following these teams, of we have the best player on the planet. No one is close to this guy, and no one can beat us. It's so hard to describe, and no one alive who missed that era understands that. You know, it's just, it's so great to reminisce about it and think about how great he was, and people just can't comprehend it. It's just impossible to describe,
especially that game, because like I just recall like being in like this weird happy feeling zone.
Yeah.
Like, cause Jordan, I think what you're trying to get at first, that people don't understand, like, when Jordan took over a game, it wasn't just, it was different. he took over, like, the team, he took over the moment. Like, it was like, he controlled everything on the floor, the motion, and what he, those timeouts meant nothing. They knew they lost, and he was just going to take over. He knew how to take over the moment.
You know what also?
He just marveled at it. You know, he just marveled at it.
You know what's that always popped out in my head that I never forgot was in that finals that Jordan and Paxson both shot over 50% from the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'll never forget that. I will never forget that because for me, that was just so unheard of that your backcourt is are both shooting over 50% from the field. I believe Mike was at like 54 and Paxson was at like 52. But it was something ridiculous. Like that's just plain old ridiculous. Like, how do you stop that? And I believe Scotty was shooting 48. And you know Horace was shooting in the high 50s. Like, that's just how he did his whole career. So it's like, how do you stop that? They were unstoppable, man. They really were. They were monstrous.
I think it's hard for people to realize, too, hitting the 6 3-pointers in the first half, that game, that era was completely different. It wasn't an era where people were even shooting, you know, 3.3 attempts in a game was, for a team, was a pretty big total. And he had six made in the first half. It would be the equivalent of someone making, like, I'd say 15 in the first half today. It was just such a mind blower. And I'll never forget. It was just the greatest achievement I've ever seen. And I remember when Rose was in his MVP year. I remember during the regular season, I think he had a game where he had 5 in a game. And I just remember even thinking, like, Jordan did that in the half, in the final. For him to raise his game to that level on the biggest stage possible, just so great. Let's go on to the next topic. Go ahead. Sir, who wanted to add something?
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, in the background, as I mentioned before, was that it was the media trying to make this whole, you know, Clyde Fessler can't shoot threes and Jordan can't. That's what I'm saying. That was the moment. Like, he seized that moment. Like, that was there. And he was like, okay, I'm taking this one. I'm going to shoot 6 threes. I'm going to be the best player in the world. Shut the F up. You know, let's win the championship. He just took over the moment. It was like, okay, everybody shut up. This is it.
Have you guys read about how he tormented Clyde during the Dream Team practices, yes, but specifically this? Yeah.
Jack, share with us a little bit to the listeners about that, just so anyone who is not aware of it.
Oh, well, the Dream Team was pretty nicely split in terms of personnel. There were like 2 really good centers, 2 really good power forwards, 2 really good shooting guards. But the idea that Jordan and Drexler was 2 really good shooting guards, like you were saying, was overdone because it wasn't 2 really good. That makes it sound like they're the same. Like you said, they weren't the same. So Jordan started going at him at the Dream Team practices, shooting threes in his face. And Clyde was like freaking out, and Barkley was like, yo, like, we're all on the same team. You gotta, you know, you really gotta take it easy. Jordan really wouldn't really listen. The next day or a couple days after, at some point still during practice, Clyde showed up and he was wearing, I don't remember if it was 2 left shoes or 2 right shoes, but he was wearing 2 of the same shoe somehow. And he like wouldn't admit it, and he wouldn't go back and change because he didn't want to like admit that he had somehow put on the same 2 shoes. And what the author writes is that came on interviews, I don't remember if it was must have been through Jordan, because he did get him for a little while. But he says that Jordan just like stored it away as like, okay, this guy's no longer a threat.
That's great.
Crazy. Wait, he put on this like 2 right shoes or 2 left shoes?
Correct.
I think it was how do you even do that? Your feet even do that? That's insane to me.
I think another thing about that final that people forget, too, is it was still fresh in Michael's mind that Portland had passed on him with the second overall pick in 84. And I think that did bother him a little bit. I still remember reading a great book. I think it was called 1984. It's called Tip Off. And one of the stories in that was, you know, during the 84 summer, when Jordan tried out for the Olympic team, Bobby Knight called whoever was running Portland. I think it was probably Dr. Jack Ramsey at the time, or one of the decision makers over at Portland, and said, "You got to draft this kid, Jordan. He's you know, one of the best I've ever seen." And Portland said, "Well, we already got Clyde Drexler," and Clyde was great. I mean, I loved him at University of Houston in 1983, Phi Slamma Jamma, incredible player. but they said, we're going to go with Sam Bowie. And then Knight was like, you're making a mistake. And he said, we need a center. And then Knight said, well, then play Jordan at center because you don't want to miss this guy. And dude, and they passed on him, took Sam Bowie. The rest is history. But Michael takes anything as an affront. And I thought that would have been so fascinating that, you know, he beat the guy that they that basically the team passed on him for because they had Clyde Drexler. And then, obviously, Hakeem Olajuwon was the first overall pick. We never got to see that in 94, 95, but that would have been fascinating, too. Let's go on.
Would you say,
go ahead.
One more question. Would you say that was kind of like the birth of Mike's, I guess, wanting to step on you and crush your neck and take your soul? Was that kind of the birth? I mean, I know it was always in him. And I know you always wanted to do it, but because the Pistons kept stopping him, he wasn't able to. Was this the first time, like, the birth of Mike stepping on you and just taking your soul and keeping you down and, you know, ripping your heart out and eating in front of you?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a great point because I don't think it wasn't like that with Magic. I mean,
yeah,
it was different. He wanted to beat Magic's ass for sure.
Right, for sure.
But I don't think it was that other level. Because they also didn't play the same position.
I think it was
that level of the affront that, like, this guy is maybe just as good as you at your position.
Good, really good insight there. That's great stuff. Let's go on to the next question. Has John Paxson, the executive, sullied the reputation of John Paxson, the player? Let me start out with this one. There's no doubt this is true. John Paxson, people don't remember or recall, but he was a huge part of us winning the first title and obviously the third title, but people forget about the first title. The game five against the Lakers, I think he had 20 points. He was just hit clutch shot after clutch shot in that game. And then obviously to win the six with the three-pointer against the Suns. He was as big as you could be in this town outside of Michael. I mean, that was one of the biggest shots. I think it's one of the top three most impactful shots in history of the Chicago Bulls is that made three. And, you know, today, after today's press conference, it's just sad to see where he's gone. So there's no doubt that his and I think it's unfair, but there's no doubt that his tenure as an executive has now just completely ruined his reputation as a player because he was one heck of a player. What say you, Jack?
It just feels weird. It feels like somehow he went through some sort of dimension and came out as like a different person. Like I've never experienced. I guess you really do have to live like a generation or two to experience this, but man. John Paxson was an absolute hero. He was super nice. I did get to meet him one time. But, you know, I thought a really interesting thing about the second three-peat was that all of Jordan's key partnerships were Pippen. He was his co-captain and his longest tenured player and the best player. And in 91 through 93, those were like three different people. And Paxson was the guy who was the longest tenured, and he and Pax were pretty close on the court, and Jordan stuck up for him in contract negotiations.
Yeah.
And then Pax, remember Pax lost his starting job in 93, and yet he's still out there on the floor, and just like that possession, it's like everybody on the floor touched the ball. It's just like, he's part of something really, really special. And then his GM career got off to a really pretty incredible start, 03 to 05 as a turnaround. But then it's like, it just feels like this whole thing has gone wrong and he's like lost in a haze. And it's just, you know, if you think about like, all right, if you are a 18-year-old, if you're a 20-year-old Bulls fan, you're like right in your prime of being an awesome sports fan. Mm-hmm. And you came along, 4 years after Paxson was even on the Bulls as a player. You don't know that guy, you know? And it's just like, man, he was such a clutch part. And I just kind of, like, a part of me just wants this era of the front office to be over.
Mm-hmm.
So that we can get back to just being like, Pax, you the man, number five, thanks, like, bro, this shit was awesome. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just like, it kind of bites.
He was a coach.
And like, I'm looking at these, because you mentioned the 91 finals, I'm looking at these stats, field goal percentage. Jordan was fifth at 558.
Fifth?
Purdue, 60%. Fifth. Purdue, 60%, Levingston 61. Okay, those guys didn't shoot much. Horace Grant on 51 field goals, 627. And Pax on two fewer field goals, 653.
Insane.
And it's just like, man, can't we have that guy? Where's that guy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big Dave. We'll go to Big Dave and C-Dub.
Yeah, you hit that on the head, Jack. I mean, two people that come into my mind when I think about him are Tony Romo and Walter White. Like, he is like the reverse Tony Romo. Because Tony Romo, when he was playing, he get destroyed. Tony Romo would get destroyed when he was playing. As soon as he stepped in front of a microphone, he's John Madden now. You know what I'm saying? Behind the mic. People love Tony Romo, man. And I think of Walter White because that's what kind of what Paxton was. Like you just said, a super nice guy. Like he was kind of like grooming to be like the next Red Kerr, you know, with the organization, you know, with the coaching, with being behind the mic. And when he became the GM, you were like, oh, man, yeah, Paxton GM, you know, he brings the toughness, the identity, the things that we need. And then a couple of those moves he made were nice. Then we had a nice little playoff team. And then we get Derrick Rose. And then we get Tim. You know, it was, and then, you know, he turned into Heisenberg. You know what I'm saying? Like, he became like this villain. And looking at him, I mean, visually, too. If you look at him, dude looks like Heisenberg now. Like, he visually looks like him, man. Like, if you saw him in a press conference today, show up in a hoodie. You know what I'm saying? With a black hoodie on, like, what? You know what I'm saying? He showed up a little differently today, man. But, yeah, man, it's so interesting how he's just changed. And I didn't think of it like that, Jack. You're right. I wanted them to go because, you know, I wanted the fresh start. You know, I didn't want them to start over. It's been just too long, and I'm just – people are upset. Like, it's to the point where, you know, where you've been fed so much crap for so long that even when, you know, they do something right, you're still going to say something wrong, you know, because of what you've been fed previously. You know, you've constantly been fed these things. So it doesn't matter. The truth doesn't matter anymore to fans. They're just going to hate. You know what I mean? Like, hate is just what it's going to be.
Yeah.
So a change has to happen to rid that. But you're right, Jack, man. Like, he needs to get rid of that so he can actually go out in the sun, man, and, you know, get his roses while he can still smell them. Show him the love, man, because he was an integral part. I mean, do you not remember him in 91 in Game 5? I mean, when he was just lights out, you know what I mean, when Mike was getting triple-teamed, that quick kick out the packs and – you know, you watch Tax shoot those jumpers. That's how you teach. You know, that's how you teach it, man. You see that hair flopping in the air. You know what I mean? Wow. And I mean, the three-peat, of course, the three-peat, you know what I mean? He hits that. And even in 92, like I said, he shot 52% from the field, man. And he was just good. Even when, even when losing his position, he still was always an important piece and an integral part of this team. And yeah, man, it's just so crazy to see the downslide of it. Of course, some of it is definitely his fault. But I just want it to be done with now, man, because he does deserve more love.
What's the easy dub?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It is like the hero to the goat kind of thing. When I think of Paxton, there's two things I think about. One is that I don't think every time he had a ball and he's open and Michael gave him the ball, I thought it was going in every time. They said it was flawless. And when his shot went all net, it like ripped the net. It like,